Here's the editor of Lenswork Publishing, Brooks Jensen.
I'm titling this podcast, The Photo Game is Changing. And it really is two interrelated thoughts, so I kind of feel like I want to lay a roadmap so you know where we're going. The first thought I'll title, When the Mystery is Completely Removed, followed by a second thought, Chemists versus Engineers. And I'll discuss both of these thoughts in this same audio file. And I hope you'll be able to connect them together, which is what's been happening in my mind. Let me begin with this idea, when the mystery is completely removed. I had a pretty substantial revelation about art years and years ago when I was visiting the Art Institute of Chicago. And there's a long hallway from the entrance down to the newer wing where there was a photography display that I wanted to see, Paul Strand. But to get there, I had to go through this long hallway, and they had artwork in this long hallway. Two pieces right next to each other that grabbed my attention with such force that I had to stop on my way to the Paul Strand exhibition and spend some time really thinking about these two pieces of artwork. Neither one of them were visual arts, not paintings, not photography, but rather one was a suit of armor from, I'm assuming, medieval England or someplace like that, and the other was a very strangely carved ball. So let me start with that one. This ball was carved out of a single piece of ivory, as I recall, and it was about 10 inches in diameter. And it had all kinds of details in the ball, little people and animals and trees, and it was a whole story, a tableau carved on the surface of this ball. But the ball was not solid because it had been carved away so that inside that ball there was another ball. And that second ball also was covered with little people and animals and landscape scenes and whatnot, all carved in ivory. But that wasn't the end of it, because inside that ball was an even smaller ball, and inside that ball was an even smaller ball. And the three-dimensional challenge of carving the small ball within a bigger ball, within a bigger ball, within a bigger ball, all from a solid piece of ivory, was simply mind-boggling. It had come from somewhere in China, as I recall. This, again, was decades ago that I saw this, so the details are a little fuzzy. But I remember part of the description of this carved ball was that it had taken several generations of this one family of artisans, to carve the entire thing. And it was simply mind-boggling. My response in looking at this incredible piece of artwork was, this can't be done. It's virtually impossible. I'm not even sure you could do it with a laser. It was that intricate, that involved, that complex, but yet here it was, something impossible to do that had been done, and that was part of its magic. Right next to it was this ancient suit of armor, all done in metal, and equally fantastic, with intricate little pieces that had been sewn together to make this complete shield for some warrior. And it had been executed with such incredible detail that once again I found myself looking at it saying, this cannot be done. But yet, there it was. It was that amazement that was so captivating that made me want to stop and look more closely and get the story and read about it in the guide. And I remember having the revelation that that mystery was a huge part of my fascination with both of those artifacts. They simply could not be done, but yet they were done. I've carried that thought with me ever since, that when I look at a piece of artwork so many times, I simply say, it can't be done. This is beyond human capabilities, but here it is. So it's amazing that it even exists. It's amazing the talent that someone had, the patience, the perseverance, the work ethic to complete whatever it is that I'm seeing. because it's that difficult. It's not humanly possible to create it, but some human did. And I remember thinking that in my earliest days in photography about the first gelatin silver prints that I saw. I would look at a Win Bullock photograph or an Ansel Adams photograph and say, wow, these are so spectacular. They're so much better than anything else I had seen, or certainly anything that I could produce in my youth. I looked at them and said, this cannot be done. The materials do not allow for this kind of presentation and this sense of excellence, but yet here I was, looking at those prints in total admiration of whoever the photographer was, because they had completed something which I knew could not be done. But in photography, there is this prejudice that photography doesn't take talent, not like drawing, not like painting, not like sculpture, not like dance. Photography, what you need is a really good camera and some technical knowledge and training. And so many photographers in my generation jumped on the bandwagon with the premise being that all we had to do was learn how to do it, and we too could exhibit that special, wonderful presence of the artifact that seems to imply it can't be done, but there it is. So we went to workshops, and we studied, and we got the books, and we spent countless hours in the darkroom refining our craft. And at the end of that long path, might have been decades, might have been years, but at the end of that long path, the functional reality is that the mystery was removed. It wasn't only Ansel Adams and Win Bullock et al. Who could make those kinds of images, but now others, maybe even ourselves, could create a gelatin silver photograph that looked that good. Now, that doesn't mean our photographs were good, because they may have been bad compositions and etc. But the craft element started to be more masterable as we spent more time with it, as we went to more workshops, gathered more information, read more books, etc. The mystery was removed. And what's left after that mystery is moved is an artifact that's considerably diminished. It's unremarkable, maybe even common. And that's what's been happening to photography in the last 50 years. When I first got started in photography, there were only, a handful or two or three photographers who could craft an image that was as spectacular as the highest masters could produce. I could probably draw up a list of those people and certainly end up with probably less than 50 individuals, maybe 100 at the most. Out of the 7 billion of us on the planet, that makes those photographers awfully special. But fast forward 50 years. And now, through the advance of technology, almost anybody can make a wonderful image, and pretty easily, and maybe not instantaneously, but in a very short period of time. Back in my film days, I would go out photographing, then come back and have to develop the film, and then make some contact prints to see what I had, and then try to go through the process of making an enlargement. And if it succeeded, then I probably had to do some spot toning and flattening and dry mounting in order to finish it. It was a lengthy procedure. Now we come back with our digital camera, upload it into Lightroom or Photoshop, fuss around with it for 15 or 20 minutes, and can make a spectacular print by simply pressing Control-P and watching the printer spit out this absolutely gorgeous image. Where's the magic? Where's the mystery? Where's the wonder? And when lots and lots and lots, millions of people can do that, the mystery has been completely removed, which I think, in the long run, has a tendency to diminish the status of photography in the art world. Its mechanical nature has always made it suspect since the invention of photography in the early 1800s. But now, with the advance of technology, what gains we had made are starting to be eroded a little bit. and that's showing up in devalued prices and the plethora of photographers and good prints that are now available everywhere on the internet, in galleries, in craft fairs. And I dare you to go to any of those places and find something that isn't as wonderfully crafted as an Ansel Adams print. So all of that begs the question, what could make photography wonderful, that is to say, full of wonder, again? If just making a print has lost some of its magic, then what are photographers doing to try to regain a little magic? Well, when I scan the horizon, what I see are two categories of photography where I think photographers are trying to make something that takes people's breath away, that has that element of magic, that sense of, this cannot be done, but here I am looking at it, so wowee, isn't it fantastic? And those two things that photographers are trying to do is what I've characterized as an orgasmograph, a peak moment of excitement, whether it's the sunset or the crashing wave or the spectacular iceberg or the magnificent safari animal. They're trying to create something that captures a subject that takes our breath away, not the photograph itself taking our breath away, or maybe I should say the print. And the other thing that photographers appear to be locked in on these days is the hyperbolic, making things in their photographs even better than they are in real life. Crank up the vibrance, crank up the color, eliminate the distractions, magnify the shallow depth of field. Use all the tricks of the trade, the craft elements that we can, to make the world more spectacular than it really is, the hyperbolic world. Those two techniques, if I can call them a technique, seem to be pretty universal these days. But they're starting to wear thin already. As a publisher, I started seeing this kind of work 5 or 10 years ago, and I wasn't quite sensitive enough to realize how strong that trend was going to be. But now I see it everywhere. The hyperbolic world, the orgasmograph subject, and both of those trends are already starting to wear a little thin. So it occurs to me that there is another way to think about what we might need in photography that would bring back some of the magic. And that is that we don't need more Ansel Adams, that is to say, more craft, and we don't need more Ouija, that is to say, being at the right place at the right time. But strangely enough, what occurs to me that we need more of is Gary Larson from the Far Side comics. The response to Gary Larson's artwork is not, my goodness, what a magnificent illustrator he is. Somebody might say that about him, but I doubt it. He does have a style. But what really amazes us about Gary Larson is not his drawings, but rather, how did he think of that? Where does his imagination go to find such strange observations and then encapsulate them with such skill in a single panel, oftentimes with just a word or two of text? What we admire in Ansel Adams was his craft. What we admire in Ouija was his sense of timing. What we admire in Gary Larson is his mind, his inventiveness, his wit, his observation of life, his sense of the absurd. And I wonder if we could bring that into photography, would that bring back some of the mystery, so that when people would look at our artwork, they wouldn't say, my goodness, he must have a good camera, or what a masterful printer he is, or what a fantastic Photoshop guru this photographer must be. Wouldn't it be interesting if they looked at photographic artwork and said, how did they think about that? What kind of incredible sensitivity did it require for them to realize the importance of that moment, or that scene, or that observation? Like I say, more Gary Larson, and less Ansel Adams. And I hesitate to use Gary Larson because he's a comedian. And I'm not saying that what photography needs is more humor. What I'm saying is what photography needs is more the inventive mind, which might be humorous, might be serious, might be spiritual, might be all kinds of things. It's photography of the mind that really counts. That's how the photo game is changing. So that's the first thought that led me to this idea that the photo game is changing. When the mystery is completely removed, things have to change. And here in 2025, I think we're still sort of catching up to what the changes in the technology have implied relative to craft and wonder. But that's not the end of the story. The second thought I have that relates back to this is what I'll call chemists versus engineers. It occurs to me that the fundamental change in photography that I don't see anyone discussing is how the foundation of craft is no longer in the hands of chemists, but now in the hands of engineers. I might make the point somewhat crudely by saying that we've evolved from alchemy to blacksmiths. And there's a lot to unpack in that idea. The first thing is that it's inherent that in that evolution is a shift towards repeatability and automation. We can make virtually unlimited number of prints with Control P. As a matter of fact, we don't even have to make those in order to create our original artwork. We can have an assistant or someone else hit Control P, and the resulting print will be no different whatsoever than if we did it ourselves. Repeatability is a huge thing that we've never had before. Now, yes, when we had negatives, we could make multiple prints, but any one of us who have done that can tell you that it's almost impossible to make two prints that are exactly identical. I first learned about this years ago. I was visiting a gallery, and the gallery owner was so proud to show me one of the Ansel Adams Aspen images. I can't remember if it was vertical aspens or horizontal aspens now. I've kind of forgotten. But the point was, the gallery owner was saying, "This is the best version of this print I've ever seen," and therefore it was being offered for a premium price. I think I've told the story about Win Bullock before, but if you haven't heard it, it's worth it. And if you have, it's worth repeating. When I was doing the Win Bullock estate prints with his daughter, Barbara Bullock Wilson, I was scanning all the original Win Bullock 8x10 and 4x5 prints to turn them into high-resolution digital files. And I was doing the scan of one of Win Bullock's most famous images called Child in the Forest. And Barbara told me the following story, that one Thanksgiving, when Win and Edna had gone over to Barbara and Jean's house for Thanksgiving dinner, after dinner was over, Win Bullock excused himself to go into the bathroom. And he was in there for the longest time, to the point where they were starting to get worried about him. But eventually he came out. And they said, "Are you okay? You know, you were in there for a long time." And he said, "Well, I was looking at that copy of Child in the Forest that you have hanging in the bathroom that I gave you as a wedding present when you two got married." He said, "That is unquestionably the best version of Child in the Forest I ever printed, and I'd like to buy it back from you." And they said, "No, we don't want to give up that print. That's a very special print because it was a wedding present that you gave to us, and so, you know, we'd like to keep it." And Barbara went into her bathroom and pulled that print off the wall, and we unframed it, and that's the image that I scanned in order to make the digital archives and the Win Bullock estate prints that we did from those scans. But think of the implication behind that story. Win Bullock made who knows how many copies of the image Child in Forest, but that one, in his opinion, was the very best one he ever made. That means that even though he maybe tried to make all of them exactly the same, you just can't. The analog materials are not that predictable. And so every print you make in a wet darkroom is going to be subtly different, especially over the years when perhaps papers change or chemicals change. Compare that to today's inkjet printing, where Control-P can make as many copies of a print that you want that are exactly alike, and the only variations will happen in the future if the paper you were using, or you change printers to a different ink set or something. But once you've done that and recalibrated the image, again, you can hit Control-P and make as many copies as you want that are absolutely indistinguishable from one another, that are perfect in terms of their reproducibility. Is that repeatability and automation, is that a blessing or a curse or both? And perhaps the more important question is, how are we taking advantage of that repeatability? It does offer certain advantages that cannot be denied. A variation on that, of course, is not repeatability of the physical print, but repeatability of the on-screen presentation. Any one of us can do an image and then post it on Instagram or our web page or however we send our digital images out into the world, and all of the replicated copies of that digital file will be virtually identical. And the only variance in viewing them will be if someone's monitor is calibrated a little differently or has a different technology in the screen. But the digital files themselves will be identical. It's just the presentation of the digital files that may vary and probably aren't going to vary all that much. How are we taking advantage of that incredible repeatability? For me, when I first realized that this was a reality in the new photography of our generation, is I started thinking of PDFs as a medium for legitimate artwork. That's taking advantage of the repeatability of an image in a way that allows me to distribute that image literally, globally, literally, instantaneously, anywhere on the planet. Again, I ask, is this a blessing or a curse or both? Well, back to the idea of chemists versus engineers. There's another aspect of this that's fascinated me for the longest time. And I characterize this with a term that seems odd, I know, talking about artwork. But I like to think about the photographers of yesteryear as the chemists of the priesthood. I think of it as a priesthood in photography. There were people who knew how to do things, and they had special gifts, maybe from God, who knows, and they could make a print in a way that the rest of us couldn't. And so what we tried to do was improve our skills and improve our capabilities so that we could join the priesthood and be as good as the masters of yesteryear. Well, now that making photographic images no longer requires the alchemy of the wet darkroom, what defines the new priesthood in photography these days? My friend Joe Lipka made the fascinating observation that in the old days, we used to learn photography from other photographers. Now we tend to learn photography from software gurus, and they may or may not be accomplished photographers, but they know Photoshop, they know Lightroom, they know Capture One, they know print profiles and custom ink sets. What defines the new priesthood? Photoshop? Is that a blessing or a curse? But this is the part where I connect these two ideas I'm discussing in this podcast. Because whether or not the priesthood are chemists of yesteryear or engineers of today's photography, either way, there's a craftsmanship about that approach that supposedly contributes to the sense of excellence. And the more those techniques are known and promoted, the less and less they contain the mystery that fills us with wonderment when we're looking at artwork. Which brings me right back to the same question I had a bit ago. What would make photography wonderful or full of wonder again? Is that going to come from the chemists of yesteryear, from the engineers of today, or is it likely to come from somewhere else? Artwork always has been, and probably always will be, this very interesting intersection between craft and content, or maybe I should say craft and thought, or craft and observation. And that observation could be anywhere on the spectrum of human emotion, humorous, tragic, happy, sad, etc. But isn't that what we need more of? That's what I'm trying to get at with the Gary Larson analogy. We look at his work and say, how did he think that? How did he come up with that idea? The execution of it in terms of his drawings were fantastic too. But that's not why we admire Gary Larson. We admire him because of what he thought, what he observed, what he saw that the rest of us didn't see, what he thought about that the rest of us didn't think about. And it feels to me that that's the area where we need to spend more time as photographers, rather than searching for better gear or better techniques or better printers or better software. What we really need to develop is ourselves, our sensitivity, our ability to think, to see, to observe, to encapsulate, to distill. And when I show my work to someone, if they say, wow, you must have a really good camera, or you must be a really good printer, or isn't it a blessing that you can travel so much? I know my artwork has failed, because they're just looking at the surface of the artifact and not the content that I'm trying to communicate through the use of craft, physical materials, or digital presentations. The photo game is changing, and I would be very suspicious of any philosophy that suggests that making more colorful, more vibrant, bigger artwork from more exotic locations, those are the current things that are exciting people in photography today. But I have a feeling that those trends are going to disappear fairly quickly. Maybe not in my lifetime, but fairly quickly. And what will make photography important and bring back the mystery and thereby the appreciation of photography as an art medium will be those photographers who bring the most of themselves and the wonderment about how they observed and what they created to the forefront, not how good their printer is or how many megapixels their camera has. The one thing that the history of photography has shown us since its invention in 1839 is that the means of making photographs is constantly evolving. And whatever technologies we use today will be obsolete in the passage of time. But whatever observations we make today that get to the heart of humanity, those will survive, regardless of how primitive the tools might have been when we look back on them as the history of photography evolves.
Copyright 2025, Lenswork Publishing.